Okay, it's my special pleasure to introduce to you the Reverend Dr. John Helwig. Dr. Helwig has served as sole pastor of Emmaus Lutheran Church in St. Louis, Missouri, since 2008, having previously served the dual parish of Grace Lutheran Church in Platte Center, Nebraska, and St. Peter Lutheran Church in Humphrey, Nebraska. He received his BA from Concordia University, Seward, Nebraska. He went on to receive his MDiv and his SDM from Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, a fine school at the other side of the river. He majored in historical theology, minored in systematic theology. It's otherwise, the other way around, of course, would be even more ideal, but that's pretty good. He later returned to Concordia Seminary to earn a PhD in historical theology with an emphasis in the modern world. You can see why he's here today. He has served as an adjunct professor of theology at Concordia University, Nebraska, and is presently serving as adjunct faculty from Concordia University, Wisconsin, St. Louis Center. I wasn't even aware that McEwen is kind of has his tentacles everywhere. Also, he serves as adjunct at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. He has taught classes both in theology and philosophy. His areas of expertise include the interaction between theology and philosophy throughout the history of the Christian Church and church history in the 19th and 20th centuries, particularly focusing on American Lutheranism. You sound like a competition for our president. But he also is interested in the history of Nazism and the Kirchenkampf. Today he will talk to us about American responses to German politics before World War II. Please welcome Dr. Helwig.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for that warm welcome, and thank you to Dr. Scare for inviting me, even though I am a product of that other seminary, the one started by that Walther guy that President Rast referred to. But also, I also think about President Rast's presentation, and he said, prepare for the gloom. I think that he's referring to my topic. So, again, thank you. But getting started, how does one analyze and evaluate the shifting scene of culture? To do so is always a difficult and somewhat dangerous proposition. It is hard to grasp where present trends are leading to, as well as knowing how one is to respond to them from a truly biblical perspective. And plus, one can never find that Archimedean point to stand outside of culture as well. For the next few minutes, I have been asked to present what can amount to a case study of how our fathers here in American Lutheranism dealt with the rise of the culture and political realities of Nazi Germany. This era, known as the Third Reich, not only brought in the atrocities of the Holocaust and the Second World War, but also created a challenge for people to understand what was happening in Germany. This was especially difficult, was evaluating what was going on in Germany before the invasion of Poland. After the Second World War and then the Holocaust began, it was easy to point to the evils of Nazi Germany. However, for the first 7 years of Hitler's reign, this was not as clear. Struggles to comprehend what was happening confronted the people in Germany itself, those outside Germany, as well as us historians ever since. In particular, the Lutherans in America followed these events with great interest because many hailed from German ancestry and virtually all were in some form of church fellowship with at least one church in Germany. While it is easy for us today to look back at this time and see Hitler's anti-Semitic warmongering speeches as portents of what was to come, in that day it was not so easy to tell what was really a sign of trouble and what was politically posturing. This was especially true for those in America, as they struggled with who do you believe? First of all, with all of the information coming out of Germany, it was confused and varied. Martin Sommer wrote in the Lutheran Witness in 1934, "One reason for this is that the information which comes to us from Germany, both through letters and through the press, varies from week to week, if not day to day. What we write today concerning the occurrences may not harmonize exactly with conditions as they will be when our readers receive this paper. Likewise, after the Great War and the great propaganda campaign that was carried out in America regarding Germany, J.T. Mueller and others stated flatly that a man cannot always believe what he reads in the daily press because they feared bias in the press. Added to this were attestations from many in Germany that things were improving greatly under Hitler. Hitler managed to increase employment and therefore helped clean up Germany. He cracked down on prostitution and some pornography. He restored dignity to Germany, highlighted by the hosting of the Olympics in Berlin in 1936. However, even in the eyes of American Lutheran observers, things were not always as good in Germany throughout the mid-1930s. More and more red flags arose, ranging from the Nazi attempts to control the Landeskirchen, known as that Kirchenkampf, to Nazi anti-Semitism, to neo-paganism in Nazi beliefs. Therefore, the 1930s displayed a shift in American Lutheran perceptions of Nazi Germany from what was initially a mixed bag to ultimately seeing it as nothing short of evil in the world. Now, when we look at American Lutherans in the 1930s, the one concern that reigned over all was the preservation of Lutheran orthodoxy. The issue that underlay every other question was the preservation of proper Lutheran doctrine. As J.E. Thoen explained in Lutheran Sentinel, when we speak of true Lutheranism, we mean nothing less than real biblical Christianity. The two cardinal principles of the Lutheran Reformation were: Scripture alone is the source and rule of Christian faith and life, and salvation by grace alone through faith in Christ Jesus. Wherever and whenever one of these fundamental principles is mutilated or lost, true Lutheranism is destroyed. If we desire that our church is to be and remain truly Lutheran, it is necessary that we adhere strictly to these principles and refuse to affiliate with those who build on other foundations by tolerating doctrines and practices contrary to Scripture. Of course, it should be noted that while American Lutherans of all stripes were adamant about the need for Orthodox Lutheranism, there was variation as to how some of the different bodies defined what was within the pale of Orthodox Lutheranism. But this led to a concern, or this concern led rather into two primary directions. First of all, we find that they attempted to evaluate all of the different events and issues through decidedly theological lenses. And secondly, this concern for Lutheran orthodoxy also manifested itself in a similar concern, first and foremost, for their fellow Lutherans. This concern was hardly out of the ordinary, though, as virtually all American Protestants showed much more concern for the co-religionists than other Christians during this era. Now, the biggest single theological disquiet that the American Lutherans had was over the threat of liberalism and modernism. In fact, American Lutherans saw this problem as lurking behind virtually all other problems facing Nazi Germany, and both in the churches and in the cultures at large. It should be noted that American Lutherans had far more unanimity on this point than they have since. In fact, out of 30 major periodicals that I have studied over the years, only one of them, and that was the Lutheran Church Quarterly, published by the Lutheran Theological Seminary at Gettysburg and the Lutheran Theological Seminary at Mount Airy in Philadelphia. This is the only periodical that defended the practice of historical criticism in this era. Definitely a shift in what we know today. But one of the more vivid ways that they saw this playing out was in how the Nazi Party and the group within the church, the Deutsche Christen, attacked the Old Testament. While most people tend to look back and see these assaults as anti-Semitism attacking the Bible, most American Lutherans saw this as historical criticism being applied in an extreme fashion. August Zitch went so far as to declare, quote, if almost any American liberal were to listen to any of the comparatively few neo-pagan Nazi preachers, he invariably would come away wondering what was wrong with it. Now, of the events in Germany, the single greatest concern for American Lutherans was the ongoing struggle for control of the Lutheran Landeskirchen that is known as the Kirchenkampf. Hitler's master plan was for a complete Gleichschaltung, or coordination, of all of German life, in which virtually every aspect of German culture and society was to be bent to serving the whims, ultimately, of Hitler. And Hitler accomplished much of this at an absolutely dizzying pace. In September of 1933, just a few months, about 9 months after Hitler's named chancellor, the American Lutherans were told, within a few months, all facilities, all organizations, all left-hand establishments, all terrestrial and church situations came under the reshaping of one man's hand, a man whose name until recently was unknown. I mean, of course, the present chancellor of the German Reich, Adolf Hitler. This movement of Gleichschaltung also included then those German churches. When Hitler rose to power, there were 28 different Landeskirchen, each operating independently of the rest. However, Hitler's master political theory included the Führerprinzip, which is the basic principle that the German people in absolutely any area could best be led by a single leader, or Führer, who personified the German folk, and therefore could lead the people via their embodiment of the German folk. In applying then this Führerprinzip to the church, that meant that the varied and divergent Landeskirchen had to be united into one Reichskirche under a single Reichsbischof. To simply describe the different parties in the battle that then came about is actually a little bit harder than it sounds. On the one side, there is a movement known as the Deutsche Christen, or the German Christians. I prefer to keep the term in the German so that we don't confuse this with Germans who are Christians. And here is a picture of shaking Hitler's hand is the ultimate Reichsbischof, Ludwig Müller, of the Deutsche Christen. But even here, talking about the Deutsche Christen, it's not so much one movement as a series of movements that were in some ways intertwined and often with one replacing another. The Deutsche Christen intended to be the Christian soul of the Nazi Party. While most of the Nazi leadership ultimately saw the Deutsche Christen more like useful idiots that could be used to bring the churches under Nazi control. Now, the resistance to the Deutsche Christen was from the beginning somewhat fractured and disorganized. The resistance was headed by a series of groups that have come to be known as the Confessing Front, or sometimes referred to as the Confessing Church, often with the same leadership shifting from one of group to the next. And these include some key figures here, Karl Barth and Martin Niemöller. However, while much of the leadership stayed largely the same throughout the period, the membership was very fluid, rising and falling as the situation changed within the Protestant Church of Germany. Further confusing matters, there was a core of more confessionally minded Lutherans who never really found themselves at home within the confessing church. This included the theological faculty of the University of Erlangen and the intact churches, namely those Landeskirchen that were never taken over by the Deutsche Christen. And these were the churches, the Lutheran churches of Bavaria, Hanover, and Württemberg. And here are their respective bishops at this time. Meiser of Bavaria on the left, August Mahrens of Hanover in the middle, and Theophil Worm of Württemberg on your right. But at times, there was cooperation between this confessional church and the confessing front. However, this tended to be spotty and varied during the 1930s. For those in America, while there was great concern over the events of the Kirchenkampf, the determination over which group or groups would be determined to be in the right was based entirely on the theological orthodoxy or the perceived orthodoxy of the respective groups. There were a few who initially saw the Deutsche Christen as a misguided attempt to reform the church through politics. However, the vast majority of American Lutherans analyzed the Deutsche Christen as theologically wanting. They saw the Deutsche Christen as being theologically liberal and therefore wrongheaded. A few authors went so far as to say that the Deutsche Christen had left true Christianity or even were outright heretics. What proved more difficult to analyze was the inherent benefits and problems of the confessing front and the confessional church. As a whole, the Americans were much more closely aligned with the confessional church, and that is with the exception of the Synodical Conference, who argued that due to theological liberalism in the Lutheran Landeskirchen, that even those churches were Lutheran in name only, and that the only real Lutherans in Germany were found in the Saxon Free Church. What, though, is especially of interest to us gathered here today are the theological lenses that the American Lutherans used to try to sort all of this out as events were rising and falling during this era. Well, one of the specific areas that American Lutheran writers in America, saw liberalism as undermining the true faith in Germany was with the prospect of unionism in the German churches. For most of the American Lutherans, this threat was shown most vividly in the formation of that Reichskirche, since this meant that the Lutheran Landeskirchen would now be part of the same church as the smaller Reformed churches and the large church of the old Prussian Union. There was also concern even over the confessing front, and whether that not. That was also a form of unionism, since it also included Lutherans, Calvinists, and members of the Prussian Union. In general, most of the writers feared unionism as an evil that would undermine the true faith. And this was a theological concern that predated attempts to create the Reichskirche in Germany. Articles are seen in American periodicals predating and well after this, showing the concerns of unionism even here in the United States. So we see that there is an overall concern over this prospect of unionism, and therefore they're also concerned when they see it arising in Germany. A couple of articles went a step further, explaining that for churches to have any form of union, they must first have unity in doctrine. The clearest statement of this was actually a quote by the German theologian Hermann Zasse in response to work on the Faith and Order, where he wrote, "The Lutheran Church has a special task laid upon it now that the movement for union has reached this point. It must reaffirm and win recognition for a principle which has been exposed to contempt and to the charge of impenitent confessionalism, namely, that true church unity is utterly impossible without unity of faith, teaching, and confession." Because of this, it was hardly surprising that the Lutheran writers in America reacted with tremendous concern in 1933 when it appeared that the Landeskirchen might be joined, placed together into this Reichskirche to form what might be a form of unionism because of the different confessions within it. These concerns were raised from a number of sources across the American Lutheran spectrum. Most of the American Lutheran writers saw this Reichskirche as a new and expanded version of the Prussian Union. Fears that were not fully realized at that time, but were actually later in 1948 with the creation of the Evangelische Kirche in Deutschland, which is even more unionistic than the Reichskirche ever was. As the decade wore on, there was a growing concern that even if the initial Reichskirche was not really unionistic, there was a growing pressure for unionism within the Reichskirche as the differences between the confessions were being downplayed. Some writers further lamented that often there were pressures on the Lutheran pastors to downplay distinctive Lutheran teachings within the church. Many of the authors were upset by the pressure by the Deutsche Christen in particular, who were beginning to press to make the Reichskirche into a fully union church. Then they later lamented when in a more extreme version, the Thuringian Deutsche Christen were pushing to create a confessionless national church. However, more of the authors actually laid the blame for the pressure for unionism right at the feet of Hitler and the Nazi Party. In particular, there was a concern that the Nazis were pushing that the ideology of Nazism was to override all of Christian teachings. Since this was a great deal of concern about the Deutsche Christen and their pushing for unionism, it's of little surprise that leaders of the church-resistant movements were also evaluated in regard to their own responses to unionism. A fairly common assessment of the confessing front was that it was inherently unionistic, as it was made up of Lutherans, the Reformed, and members of the Prussian Union. The Barmen Declaration was specifically singled out as an example of a new declaration of faith that did not take into account the varying confessions. However, these criticisms were not entirely without moderation. Several of the writers, while not overly happy about the unionism within this movement, understood it as a possible necessary evil in order for these churches to work together to combat the far greater evil of the Deutsche Christen. For many of the Lutherans in America, especially with those in fellowship with the Lutheran Landeskirchen, there was a hope and pride that the confessional church was succeeding in avoiding unionism. In particular, there was a certain amount of encouragement that came from the fact that the Lutheran bishops of the intact churches refused to allow their churches to be swallowed up in a union within the Reichskirche. There was also a fair amount of praise for the Lutheran leaders in Germany who refused to join the unionistic confessing front. A number of writers expressed their joy when the confessional church and the confessing front finally and ultimately parted ways. Now, when it came out to trying to figure out how do you unravel the Gordian knot that was Nazi Germany, the first theological distinction that the American Lutherans used was the distinction of the two kingdoms or the two realms. However, during this period, the term the two kingdoms is conspicuously absent from the discussion, as most American Lutherans preferred instead to refer to it as the doctrine of the separation of church and state. For many American Lutherans, the American separation of church and state was seen as an ideal example of the way it should be. It appears that the American Lutherans were conflating the American political dogma of the separation of church and state with Luther's distinction of the two realms. And here we see how they were becoming victims of their own culture here in America and conflating their doctrine with the cultural realities. Yet, they kept clear that they really had a concern that the separation of church and state must be properly maintained. And this was reflected in numerous articles and books published during that time. While there were more than a couple absolutely shocking endorsements of Hitler and Nazism during the 1930s, much of the praise that American Lutherans had for Luther was explained as how he was fulfilling his responsibility in the civil realm to take care of the German nation, its culture and its people. In this, the American Lutheran publishers reminded their readers regularly of the terrible state that Germany was in when Hitler first came to power. The publishers gave their greatest support for Hitler in response to how quickly he turned around the German economy. There was a certain amount of amazement at just how positive things were starting to look for the German people within the first couple of years of Hitler's tenure. This included an emphasis on unemployment and how the German nation was working to uphold the value of labor. As Lars Boe observed, judging superficially, they seemed to be solving many of their difficulties in Germany and other European lands far better than we are here. unemployment is not as great, one gets the impression that they are approaching their problems not merely from the negative standpoint of relief, but on the more constructive platform of trying to get everyone on an earning and self-sustaining basis. The greatest fear that gripped the American Lutheran publishers was the spread of communism. There were numerous articles about the threat even of the spread of communism within the United States. This led them to breathe a collective sigh of relief that Hitler had saved Germany from the specter of Bolshevism. In this regard, Hitler was seen as a savior in the left-hand realm by keeping communism out of Germany, often even beyond Germany, as he was considered to be the first to stop that rising red tide. Another problem the writers saw as having gripped Germany until Hitler eradicated it when he came to power was rampant immorality. This included the problem of widespread publication of pornography in Germany. There was also concern about the widespread publishing of Bolshevik and anti-Christian literature in Germany. To this end, some of the authors even endorsed, or at least spoke of how they understood the Nazi book burnings as a legitimate means of cleaning up the society. However, others were rather concerned about this, but especially about just how widely the Nazis appeared to be casting their nets regarding which books were legitimate for the fire. This does not mean that the Nazi government was entirely seen as good, though, by the American Lutherans. For many of the American Lutherans, much of what was being done early on in the civil realm in Germany was seen as very positive. For instance, when asked by a reader how the Lutherischer Herald could speak so positively about the Nazi regime, C.R. Tappert responded that what Hitler was doing in the secular realm was good. The only problems arose was when he meddled in the churches. Concerns were occasionally also raised in the left-hand kingdom about the treatment of the Jews. However, the greatest concern for the American writers was with Hitler's regime and that the Nazi government was mixing the church and the state. For many, what was going on in the civil realm in Germany was praised. And a few even offered glowing support for Hitler in the early 1930s. Sadly, for us to say in the Missouri Synod, some of the most vocal praise was found in the Walther League Messenger by Walter A. Meyer in April of 1933, when he described Hitler as a natural-born leader, accented by serious and sober judgments, and moved by a rare understanding of Germany's essential needs. Then in July of 1933, Hans Kirsten, a Lutheran pastor in Germany, praised Meyer's article as calm, unprejudiced opinion, and referred to Hitler as one of the great men of our history, but who, up to this time, has been maligned and dragged through the dirt of the streets by the unscrupulous foreign press under Jewish control. However, these statements were questioned by readers, and within a year or two, Meyer completely repudiated Hitler and his totalitarianism as he came to realize what he was really talking about there as far as the nature of Hitler. For most of the Americans, it was hard to miss the antagonism that existed between the two realms in Nazi Germany. For some, these tensions were seen as unavoidable, since there was a strong church and a strong government involved, and especially when elements of nationalism were being injected into both. The readers of the Kirchliche Zeitschrift were advised that the nature of the massive upheaval that Germany had experienced placed a great stress on the church, and it warned German churches as well as Americans that they should not fall into the extremes of quietism or getting caught up in the moment of the hour, and thereby fail to rightly distinguish the two realms. Some of the writers saw the clash of the church and state in Germany as inevitable because both were making totalitarian claims on the individual. This was seen as a radical clash of worldviews that each claimed to give total meaning to one's life, and therefore the two would be forced into a battle. Karl Barth was cited in the Lutheran Companion as pointing out this unavoidable conflict. Quote, Nazism, he says, is not only a political experiment, but is maintained as a religious institution of salvation. The church cannot, therefore, adopt a neutral attitude. As a result, many saw the Nazi program of Gleichschaltung as a real threat to the church, since the church was seen as being forced into the Nazi program and worldview. There were, however, a few voices that said that there really wasn't a problem of the two kingdoms in Germany. These writers insisted that Hitler and the Nazis were actually in favor of a Lutheran separation of church and state. While this may sound incredible to us today, as proof, they pointed to numerous statements by Hitler and other Nazi leaders that they were in favor of this type of such separation. The most common cited source was how Hitler argued in Mein Kampf that the political leader cannot be a religious reformer. They also cited Hitler's various speeches in which he declared that he was not interested in meddling in the church's affairs. There were some writers that even held out hope that Hitler was going to step in and preserve the separation. And beyond just Hitler, some of the Nazi leaders, including Gottfried Federer, Joseph Goebbels, Hermann Göring, and Hans Kerl, were also quoted to show that they were truly in favor of keeping a proper separation between church and state. For most, there was a great concern the Nazi government was in fact attempting to make the German churches subservient to the state via the Reichskirche, particularly through the Deutsche Christen, and that they especially were guilty of mixing the church and state. Henry Smith Leiper went so far as to say that in Germany, God was allowed only if he salutes Hitler. Michael Roy, in light of Hitler's call for church elections in 1937, stated that one of the three main questions facing the German church was, should the Protestant church become an instrument of the Nazi state? While it seemed clear to virtually all of the American Lutherans that the Deutsche Christen were guilty of mixing church and state, some went a step further and saw all of the Landeskirchen as guilty as well. This was seen primarily as from Americans who were in fellowship with the Free Church in Germany of the Synodical Conference, most notably the Missouri Synod and the Wisconsin Synod. They viewed any form of a state-related church as an improper mixing of church and state, and therefore viewed all sides of the Kirchenkampf as equally guilty on this count. It was made clear to the American Lutheran public, though, also, that the fights between church and state in Germany were all confined within the Landeskirchen, and the various free churches were not affected. Since the preservation of pure Christianity was of foremost concern for the American Lutheran churches, it is also important to understand their concern over the existential threat to Christianity in Europe that was being posed by communism. Not only was communism seen as a force for evil, but it was also considered to be synonymous with atheism. And this was no idle concern, for as historian James Kegel describes it, during the same period that the Kirchenkampf was raging in Germany, the entire Russian Lutheran Church was wiped out. It is important to keep this backdrop in mind when we investigate the American Lutheran reaction to Hitler. What often appears as approval of National Socialist aims and an apparent excusing of the excesses in religious policy or anti-Semitism is often based in contrast with Stalinism in Russia. It seems likely that American Lutherans would have been less forbearing and willing to excuse German government claims without the example of Stalinist terror. For the American Lutherans, the Soviet Union's persecution and systematic attempts to eradicate Christianity was the single greatest threat to all Christianity. These concerns overshadowed all reports of persecution and even that of Jews in Germany during this era. And here it's important to keep in mind that the actual Holocaust didn't begin until early 1940 after the outbreak of the war. And so the worst had not yet happened. There were a number of voices, though, of outrage as to how the American press was busy lamenting the persecution of Jews in Germany while overlooking the widespread murder and destruction of Christians in the Soviet Union. One of the most vocal critics of this perceived injustice was our own Walter A. Meyer, who wrote of communism, "The Christian must renew his vow of hostility to this enthroned blasphemy and redouble his interest and prayers in behalf of the oppressed millions of Christians in Russia, concerning whom we have heard far less than the alleged persecuted Jews of Germany." This concern led to a general agreement that Hitler's rise to power was good and that it stopped communism from spreading into Germany. However, the perception of how good this was varied greatly. A number of stated that Christians should be thankful for Hitler because he stopped communism from spreading in Germany and therefore to other areas of Europe as well. However, others were more concerned that while stopping communism in Germany was good, Hitler was not much better. The Lutheran Herald editorialized that the issue between the choice of a red or brown dictator, the German people decided for Hitler, who was at least in favor of some form of religion as against the atheistic communists. Now, next to Marxist atheism, the rise of neo-paganism in Germany was the greatest threat to the continued existence of Christianity in the eyes of the American Lutherans. Referencing our previous talk, this is why I personally get a little nervous seeing flags in the sanctuary. Congregations. I see images of this repeated. Though our own nation is not like Nazi Germany, it's too many similarities of mixed allegiance for my tastes. But anyway, here there was a series of movements that sought to undermine the Christian church and even supplant it. As a result, the editors of these periodicals commented on the various neo-pagan movements and reported with alarm their growth in power and prestige. While every American Lutheran group was concerned about this German neo-paganism, the assessment of how rampant it was, and even the nature of it, varied greatly. There were a few who saw the neo-pagans as a vocal, yet largely powerless minority. Others explained that these groups were small, but wielded a disproportionately large amount of power. And still others saw this neo-pagan movement as a fairly large and quickly growing threat to the existence of Orthodox Christianity. Of those that saw it as a real threat, there were a number of citations of how the neo-pagans were calling for an end to Christianity in Germany. While there was never unanimity amongst the American Lutherans as to whether or not there was a uniform persecution of Christians by the Nazi, most did see at least sporadic examples of the persecution of the church. This was most keenly felt by the Americans who were in fellowship with one or more of the Landeskirchen, as those in fellowship with the Saxon Free Church tended to see these persecutions as more of punishments for political meddling by pastors and church leaders. Those that did perceive actions by the Nazi government as a persecution of Christians, faithful pastors and bishops, were quick to sound the alarm and denounce these measures. By late 1938, even Michael Roy, who was the last major American Lutheran apologist for the Nazi government, saw Nazism as anti-Christian and demonic. Not that it was trying to destroy the church, but rather to control it. Related to the neo-pagan ideas that were spreading in Germany were also some new theological ideas that made their way into the German churches as well. And American Lutherans wrestled with these new constructs. These ideas were at least partially connected to the neo-pagan ideas, yet they were given a distinctly Christian hue, making it all the harder to evaluate. These ideas were supported by some of the greatest German theologians of the time, who therefore offered their support to the Nazi cause. In 1926, seven years before Hitler comes to power, Adolf Hitler declared Article 24 of the Nazi Party program to be unalterable. And this article stated, "We insist upon freedom for all religious confessions in the state, providing they do not endanger its existence or offend the German racist sense of decency and morality. The party as such stands for a positive Christianity, without binding itself denominationally to a particular confession. It fights against all the Jewish materialistic spirit at home and abroad, and believes that any lasting recovery of our people must be based on the spiritual principle, the welfare of the community comes before that of the individual. This, of course, begs the question, what is meant by positive Christianity? However, Hitler and the Nazis shrewdly left the term undefined, thereby allowing others to pour into it whatever meaning they wanted. And so at first, many of the American Lutherans saw positive Christianity as a good thing. For instance, August Pieper defined positive Christianity as Christianity that was not liberalism. The most thorough and glowing review of positive Christianity argued that there really is no negative Christianity. Therefore, it is positive in that it is in favor of holding firm to the faith. And the author pointed to Luther and that the crucified and risen Christ is the doctrine on which the church stands or falls. Therefore, positive Christianity holds this with no compromise. The American editors applauded what they perceived as this firm stand for the truth of the gospel. However, as the 1930s went on, more and more Lutherans became skeptical due to the nebulous nature of positive Christianity. First, there was a suspicion that it might be a means of manipulating people. And by the end, most came to conclude that this was actually more of a form of a social gospel idea formed to support the Nazi reforms. Now, one of the most core aspects of Nazi ideology that's behind their politics and their worldview and everything was that there was something unique and vital about the German people as a folk. And out of this came a form of folkish theology. Scholar and expert in Nazi neo-paganism, Carla Pova, adroitly defines the concept of folkish as a term that refers to the sense of being grasped by the reality of nation that arises out of the unity of space, blood, and spirit, and that constrains all into one community, Volksgemeinschaft. Here, nation is the concrete spiritual mediator between providence and the individual. And note, this definition assumes the fusion of religion and politics, religion and nation, biology and spirit, as well as tragedy and heroism. These are all aspects that made German faith so compelling to those who regarded Christianity as a part of the demise of Western civilization. And so as such, Paul Puva also notes that this is not, in fact, and at root a Christian notion at all, but is rather a neo-pagan idea. In the extreme form, folkish thought was found in a type of dualism that viewed the world as embattled in a struggle between forces of good and evil, with the German folk being the representatives and the embodiment of good, and the Jewish folk as the representatives and embodiment of evil in the world. While this really is at root neo-paganism, as Pova points out, there were, in fact, Christian thinkers in Germany, such as Immanuel Hirsch and Paul Althaus, that attempted to moderate this by arguing that one of the orders of creation that God placed in the world was the folk, and that, therefore, the church was in a given part of the world was especially responsible to its particular folk. Some of the American Lutherans, therefore, took a more sympathetic view of this folkish theology and saw it away as explaining how the church had a responsibility to the people to which they were called. And it was therefore seen as an extension of the traditional Lutheran teaching of the orders of creation. In particular, a fair bit of attention was paid to Althaus' work on the orders of creation. Much of Althaus' emphasis on this was applauded, especially how he emphasized the Lutheran understanding that the orders of creation, while God ordained, are nonetheless tainted by human sin. Some of the American writers echoed Althaus' teaching that since God placed us within these orders, one has a duty to live within and serve these orders. Therefore, the church in a given area has called a specific call to serve its folk in which it has been placed. Althaus, however, was praised for insisting that while he felt bound to his folk, he was first and foremost a Christian and would not give that up. While there were some who applauded the extension of the orders of creation to include the folk, others were rather skeptical about it. There were some rather strong denunciations of this theological move. In particular, it was seen as undermining the gospel, since advocates of folkish aspect to theology tended to make the church subservient to the folk. Some writers were further concerned that in Germany, the civic leaders were attempting to force the church to become subservient to this neo-pagan folkish thought. This came later in the 1930s, though, especially from 1937 on. The German theologian that some American authors highlighted for his criticism of folkish theology was Hermann Zaza. Zaza was praised not only for rejecting the notion that Lutheranism was somehow a Germanic religion rather than universal Christianity, but he was also praised for arguing that in the Bible, the only folk that mattered was the folk, or people of God. Zaza further argued that the idea of the folk would have been foreign to the reformers since it came out of rationalism. The confessions, Zaza said, give us the natural orders as A, natural law, B, marriage and family, and C, economy. And then Zaza pointed out that the correct order of priority is A, marriage and family, B, economy, and C, politics. Zaza further argues, within these orders, the folk has no place. Now, the one aspect that is most often discussed and questioned was about how American Lutherans viewed Nazi anti-Semitism. In this regard, the record, especially early on, is decidedly mixed. On the one side, there were published two multi-part articles which were both entitled, rather chillingly, Die Judenfrage. This is the term used in Nazi Germany, and these articles read like something that would have been published under the very direction of Goebbels himself. It's one of those things I cannot prove it, but it's possible that these were actually planted by the Nazi Party because they were trying to get things published in other nations to get support, but that's purely speculation. However, the majority of American Lutherans rejected these views, and even by the middle of 1934, these ideas were no longer put into print in America. Rather, a common theme that was echoed time after time was that we should show love to the Jews as our neighbor, and therefore they are included in the biblical command to love your neighbor as yourself. The writers from a variety of Lutheran church bodies all agreed that Christians have a duty towards all, including Jews, to treat them with respect and love. They then pointed out that this duty eliminates all possibility for racial hatred. But again, we have to remember that during this time period, this is also muted because it is so far overshadowed by Stalin's oppression of Christianity in Russia. It fell to Elias Newman of the Zion Society for Israel to be the one to lead in the defending of Luther from charges that he was anti-Semitic and that the Lutheran ideas were actually behind Nazi anti-Semitism. Newman, a Lutheran of Jewish descent, was able to stand up and argue from in some ways a perspective stronger than that of the Gentiles, that Luther was distinguishing between the Jewish race and the Jewish religion. He wrote, quote, Luther was no anti-Semite. His violent language was always directed against the Jewish religion, which he considered false, and never against the Jewish race. Now, in conclusion, years later, looking back at what was happening in Germany, Hermann Zaza wrote to Kurt Marquardt that the confessionally Lutheran professors at first sympathized with the Nazi movement because they did not understand its revolutionary and anti-Christian character. They lacked the great gift of discerning spirits. They did not know that Hitler was a criminal. Unfortunately, some of our Free Church brethren were also blind. Hitler would never tolerate a church which did not accept his program, including all the laws against the Jews and even faithful Jewish Christians. But the Lutherans in Germany were blind. Nothing has done more damage to the name of Lutheranism in Germany than this complete failure to see the realities of Nazism and to apply the eternal law of God also to Hitler and the political powers of the world. In some ways, this charge can be leveled at the American Lutherans as well. Partially, this comes from the fact that these Lutherans in Germany were some of their primary sources of information. However, as we've seen also, though, their physical and cultural distance did help them to do a better job of analyzing what was happening in Germany than their brethren in Germany. It seems that at times in their attempts to analyze what was happening within Nazi Germany, they were blinded by and being led astray by their own ties to culture. Their ties to the culture in Germany sometimes confused them and led them to look positively on some of the good things and downplay some of the bad. Their ties to American culture sometimes muddled their own theology, such as the separation of church and state. But more than anything else, we also find that when they were working to really honestly use their theological tools concerning worries over liberal thought and keeping pure to the scripture, concerns over the true faith being undermined by unionism, as well as applying the correct limits of the state according to the doctrine of the two kingdoms, the need to love your neighbor and then also their analysis of these new theological movements in Germany, it appears that these are the times they ended up coming up with the right answer. In fact, it appears that the more that American Lutherans were mesmerized by culture and secular concerns, the more trouble they had with giving a proper analysis of the situation in Germany. But the times that they leaned more heavily upon their theological standards, they were better able to see clearly. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Helwig. And we have some time for questions before we move over to the chapel. So if you have any questions, please.
Jonathan Naumann, Oakmont. There are a couple of anecdotes that I've heard over the years, and one was from a Slovak pastor who was a student at the St. Louis Seminary when Dr. Meyer had the students sing Deutschland über alles and stand, and he wasn't German, and I think he actually reported it to the dean. Is there any sort of scuttlebutt around St. Louis today about how the students used to sing this?
That's not really talked about much, to be honest. It is, you know, one of those things that is fairly well known that, especially early on, Meyer was rather enamored with, particularly how Hitler turned around the German nation. And really, when we think about it, as far as cracking down on pornography and prostitution and turning around the economy, cleaning up things, just literally physically getting the trash off the streets and all that, it's really almost staggering how quickly Hitler did that. And I think there was a net tendency to overshine that and let that overshine, rather, the negatives.
Yeah. Old Pastor Lovcheck didn't give a date for this, but it could have been the early 30s.
I would imagine it had been pretty early. Meyer's greatest support is seen in 33 and a little bit in 34. By 35, that's gone.
Now, my wife, who's a historian of the deaconess movement, was going through old magazines. You mentioned the Walther League Messenger. Well, the deaconess movement had a magazine that went around. And I remember looking at a travelogue from a deaconess student visiting Germany from the summer of 1939. No less, and it was just a breathless, enthusiastic story about how she looked forward to seeing the much maligned but nevertheless great man.
Yeah, and those were common throughout the 1930s. And some of those you look at and go, wait a minute, this is 39. We're on the eve of war, but yet you were still seeing a few of those.
Question concerning neo-paganism in Germany. There seems to be a rise of that again, in the world and in our community. Some people wear black armbands on St. Patrick's Day because he brought an end to paganism. They see him bringing an end to paganism in Ireland. But as far as Germany goes, where neo-paganism really took hold with the whole Aryan aspect of the German people, neo-paganism doesn't seem to be that much a part of fascism in Italy or Spain as in Germany. And so I guess my question is, did neo-paganism have such a rise in Germany because it was just part and parcel of what Nazism was? Or was it maybe the state of the church being not as, you know, in those other two countries being primarily Roman Catholic?
Right.
Did the state of the church in Germany just keep the door open for that?
It's a combination of issues. Yeah, you're right. The fascism, the true fascism of Mussolini, say, or Franco, does not have as much of the neo-paganism. Late Mussolini does start to bring it in, but he's clearly importing it from Nazism and was criticized roundly by many for that. I think that combination of, yes, the Roman Catholic Church and giving more uniformity and more control as part of it. Part of Mussolini's moves to consolidate power was actually partnering with the Roman Catholic Church in various ways. And so there's some limiting there. Mussolini disdained the Catholic Church, but he was willing to make agreements to get the control he wanted. I think the other thing really is this, not only the fracturing of Protestant theology and theological liberalism, but also German philosophy. And what is happening in those in the time leading up to that. You have much more anti-Semitism that is a part of German philosophy. The Germans, and when the Nazis come forward, they can start pointing very quickly to even cultural greats like Wagner as anti-Semites and bringing out some of that as well. Part of it as well goes all the way back to, as you're trying to recount the German heritage, there's always the thing, and this goes back to, there's even feelings of this in the Reformation, as far as this, the Roman Catholicism is forced on us from the outside. And of course, the Nazis go way further than the Reformers do, to where they're saying we're going to need to throw off all of this and get back to, and there's some that want to go so far back as to, let's reinstate worship of Woden, or Odin, and Frida.
It was Hitler.
And that. Most others don't go that far, but rather go into this kind of a dualistic, embodied dualism form of neo-paganism. But I think that the philosophy is a lot of that as well.
We have time for a 30-second question and a one-minute answer.
You think sometimes we confuse our terms as far as Nazism being right-wing and communism left-wing? After all, Nazism is just an abbreviation for National Socialism, and we're really talking about, in my mind, two gangs of gangsters fighting over the same turf, and somehow there's this confusion, I think, and I think Jonah Goldberg pointed this out in his book, Liberal Fascism, mm-hmm. that really what you're dealing with is just much of a socialistic philosophy as Marxism.
Yeah. I can't cite chapter and verse where this is from, but I understand that the division of the two as right wing and left wing actually was started by the communists, by the Marxists, as a way of distancing themselves from Nazism. The key differences between them is Marxism is advocating an international socialism that all are to be all nations are to be subsumed and the workers of all nations are to unite, etc., whereas Nazism is a national socialism. It is nationally bound, and it's bound to that individual people. The other key difference is that the Nazis as a whole are saying you can still own the company so long as the government can dictate to the company what it does, whereas Marxism is the nation itself is going to, or the people themselves are going to own all of the property. So.
Thank you very much.